This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Last week I talked about uncertainty, and I talked about uncertainty from the perspective of dependent arising. And dependent arising is a fundamental Buddhist teaching. It underlies all Buddhist teaching. And it's a summation or a short form of dependent arising is this exists, that exists. This arising, that arises. This not existing, that no longer exists. This ceasing, that ceases. It's a fundamental Buddhist teaching. Now you might say, well, the Buddha taught suffering. He taught about liberation from suffering. The two go hand in hand. When you reflect on the reality of things as they are, you'll see into the nature of suffering, you'll see into the nature of dependent arising. As I was contemplating, I've been working, I was working a while back with Dogen's Actualizing the Fundamental Point. For those of you who are new, Dogen was a 13th century Zen master in Japan who went back to China when he was, in his 20s, still looking for this answer to his question. And it basically the question was to something he had heard, saying that we are already enlightened. But he couldn't get why. Well, he had a sense of why that is, but he couldn't get a satisfactory answer, and he couldn't come to it himself, so he went back to China. And he experienced realization there, and he came back. And this is one of his first fascicles that he wrote, Actualizing the Fundamental Point. And when I was going, in my studies into dependent arising, I was reading a book, the Sutra on Causation. It's a translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi of the Buddha's teachings on dependent arising. And it said that when one realizes enlightenment, awakening, it's one's duty to come to teach dependent arising. And that's what Dogen did. He came back. This is one of his early fascicles. And it's clearly what's going on here. So I'm going to try to start with Dogen, and I'm going to try to maybe touch back on uncertainty, why there's uncertainty, and sort of meander around a little bit. If you'll stay with me, I'll try not to be too unfocused. So the Actualizing the Fundamental Point, Genjo Koan, it starts with, as all things are Buddha Dharma. As all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice and birth and death, and there are Buddhas and sentient beings. And the next sentence is, as the myriad things are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient beings, no birth and death. And then the third sentence, the Buddha way is basically leaping clear of the many and the one. Thus there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings, and Buddha. Actually, he could have just stopped with the first sentence. Because when you think about the Paticca-samuppada, which I just quoted you, the short form of dependent arising, all things come into existence due to causes and conditions, and they fall away due to causes and conditions. All things. That means all things, stuff coming up in us, the patterns, our emotional states, all that is due to it comes about because of dependent arising, given the right conditions, okay? And we tend to, keep that in mind, because that's quite a sentence, that first sentence, because It's telling us that nothing is left out. Nothing. The so-called good and bad or whatever. That we and the so-called good and bad in us. And that has to do, this is important in our practice, in our meditation practice, in what we learn to pay attention to. It's the whole ball of wax. So the 12 links, I'm going to focus on about the first 8 or 9, and I'll go through the first ones kind of quickly. And I'll be, I'm going to back up here. Yeah, I'll go through the first 8 or 9, and I'll try to line them up with Dogen here. The next sentence out of Dogen is, yet in attachments blossoms fall, and aversions weeds spread. And then the next section, he starts out, to carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. So there's a key here, that to carry yourself forward, to carry yourself forward. And then the famous line in the Genjo Koan is, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things. So we're going to look at this forgetting the self thing. Okay? That's the knot. So the first link of dependent origination is ignorance. The second is volition, or our habit formations, our habit emotional states. And the second one is consciousness. All right? And this consciousness is the start of the sense of self. Okay? Because it starts to distinguish experience as this and that. This separate than that. And that's the first step in delusion. The sense of separateness. Okay. The next link, then the fourth link, is name and form, or mind and body. And then the next is the six senses, you know, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And mind. Mind is a sense organ. And then contact, and then feelings, and then craving, and then clinging. Okay. So the second one, the volition or habit formations, they carry karmic energy. Okay. They're what, you know, they propel, they keep things going. And karma is either wholesome, unwholesome, or neutral. And then coming into the eighth and ninth links, the craving and clinging, that's also where the karmic action is. And so when we think about ignorance, you know, it's ignorance of what follows. And then we look at the karmic formations, the habit formations, that karmic energy, that's what's coloring what's coming, that starts to color what's coming, you know, into consciousness, name and form, body, and then the perceptions, you know, with the sense and the contact. As the sense organs come into contact, and then there's feeling. You know, feeling we're talking about pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. And then the craving and the clinging. That's where the reification of self is. Okay, it's right there. It's the root of suffering, the Buddha said, the sense of self. And it's important, you know, when in Buddhist psychology, when you look at it, he lays out the working parts and how they work together. And he says, when you look at the working parts, and that can even be, there's even a shorter version of that in terms of the five aggregates, because the five aggregates are all in what we just talked about. Form, feelings, perceptions, habit formations, and consciousness. In those dynamics, those are just process, you know, those are just energy patterns in us, processes in us, And arising from that is this sense of self, this thought of I am. And so in craving and clinging, you know, that intensifies this sense of separateness. It just gets more, it gets deeper. And so Dogen is saying, you know, he's following the wheel here. Yet in attachment, blossoms fall. In attachment, still there's impermanence. Things are impermanent. It's going to happen despite how much we cling to them. And in aversions, weeds still spread. What we don't want still spreads. So it's kind of futile. And then he says, to carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. And that's what we're working at here. It's delusion. Right? That myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. Seeing into that is awakening. Seeing into our selfing dynamic, seeing the carrying of self forward is awakening. That's our practice. That's at the heart of our practice. Now we tend to focus on the big stuff. I'm guilty of this. I talk a lot about activation, when we're activated. And that's when stuff is right in our face, right? But it's going on all the time. This reification of self is going on all of the time. It's, you know, these minor irritations or just the minor experiences and how it's assessed and put together. And so there's this reification of habit patterns all the time. You might meet somebody, you might hear a sound, which I'm going to get into here shortly. You might hear a sound and in your ear there's irritation. There's a pattern that irritation, right? That's aversion. Okay. Now you might notice we just finished the sesshin, the Tanjiwe sesshin here this last week. There are these little things on post here and there, these little sayings, and they come from a Theravada monk by the name of Tahania. He's in Myanmar. And I came across this article in Tricycle by him, and I thought this is perfect. Okay. I was once sitting in meditation while listening to my teacher Shui Omin Sayadaw giving a Dhamma talk. My mind was very calm, but suddenly I saw it become highly agitated. How did this happen? How did anger arise in the mind so quickly when it was peaceful only moments before? In that moment, I noticed something very interesting. My mind became curious. It became curious about what had happened. It wanted to know about itself. It wanted to know why it had lost its peacefulness and had become angry. So it backed up a bit, and it began to ask questions. Its interest in knowing itself then changed the mind's quality away from anger. It wanted to learn and know the truth, and because of that, it began to gently watch the anger run its course. As I continued to sit, I was able to watch aversion operating in the mind. There's that word again, aversion. On the one hand, the mind was straining to hear what my teacher was saying. On the other hand, a group of children were making a noise just outside the meditation hall. I wanted them to stop. And I saw the mind complaining about the noise and complaining that I couldn't hear my teacher's talk. Some strong feelings came up. The observing mind saw everything that was going on in the mind. Think about that. Just that ability to see, to observe, to be aware. Can you see how expansive the mind's field of view was at this point? After it saw itself going back and forth between these two sides for a while, it saw, you know, the two sides, attachment, aversion. Aversion to the kids' noise, attachment to wanting to hear the teacher. It saw the dissatisfaction, the aversion. The mind realized that it had taken one kind of sound, which was the sound of my teacher's voice, and see, the, you know, the sound, the contact, sense, contact, sound, just sound, which was the sound of my teacher's voice and labeled it good and favorable, whereas the sounds of other people talking were bad, unwanted sounds. In this moment of realization, the mind didn't favor one object or another. It was able to hear sounds just as sounds. Without buying into the story, the mind was telling about good sounds and bad sounds. At that point, the mind stopped both its craving to hear my teacher's voice and its aversion to the voices of the people who were talking. Instead, the mind just remained in the middle and continued watching with interest. The mind saw suffering and just died down. This is how to meditate, with interest and inquiry. Every time one or more of these three unwholesome root qualities, craving, anger, and confusion, arise. The Buddha called this vital quality of inquiry in the mind Dhamma Vicaya, which means a mind that naturally investigates reality. It is a mind that studies itself by asking questions to discover what is happening and why it is happening. It's looking into the causes, into the dependent arises, the causes and conditions. The mind wants to know the nature of the three unwholesome root qualities. Often practitioners pay attention to mindfulness and right effort, but they forget to practice Dhamma Vicaya. They forget to investigate and to ask questions about experience in order to learn. But mindfulness is about understanding. You have to use wise thinking to decide how to handle things. You cannot limit your practice to continuously being aware. That's not good enough. The unwholesome roots are very dominant in the mind. They are very experienced, very skillful, and they will always get their way if we are not aware. If you don't fully recognize them and bring in wisdom, they will take over the mind. The equanimity that came when I was listening to my teacher and the visitors talk was the result of true understanding of the nature of liking and disliking the mind, and the true understanding of the nature of dependent arising. This arose through observation and investigation of the discomfort I was feeling. In the same way, as you recognize any mental discomfort, turn your attention toward it to learn all you can about it, to study the self, right? Dogen, study the self. If you can see subtle mental discomfort, watch it change. Does it increase or decrease? As the mind becomes more equanimous and sensitive, it will recognize subtle reactions more easily. Always take the arising of an unskillful root quality as an opportunity to investigate its nature. That's all things are Buddha Dharma, right? Even unskillful root quality. It's due to causes and conditions. It's not a permanent thing. Ask yourself questions. How do the unwholesome roots make you feel? What thoughts arise? How does what you think affect the way you feel? How does what you feel affect the way you think? What is the attitude behind the thoughts? How does any of this change the way you perceive pain? I would say emotional and physical pain. The mind needs to be directed, and Dhamma Vicaya does that. Once you set a direction for the mind, it will continue in that direction. This is a natural quality of the mind. If you leave the mind undirected, there will be chaos. I'm going to go back to In this moment of realization, the mind didn't favor one object or another. It was able to hear sounds just as sounds without buying into the story the mind was telling about good or bad. At this point, the mind stopped both its craving to hear my teacher's voice and its aversion to the voices of the people who were talking. Instead, the mind just remained in the middle and continued watching with interest. I would suggest that's Dogen's forgetting the self. Dogen goes on to say in the forgetting the self,
we can look on page 12.
Different copy.
Yeah. Column.
Thank you. So a little ways down, he says, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. There's a shift happening here when the selfing membrane, this membrane of self begins to thin out. When we're not filling up, the self is not filling up the room. The ego is not filling up the room. Perspective begins to shift. It's just not all about me. Other things start to come in. The world gets more vibrant. We start to relate to each other differently. We hear each other differently. We actually start to hear and experience each other differently, the world differently. There, that separation, that sense of separation of me and mine begins to fall away, and we see what the world is like. We get more intimate. This is a very intimate practice. The intimacy with ourself and the intimacy with all that's around us. That membrane gets really thin. Dogen goes on further on in the section that starts when Dharma does not fill your body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. And I think this sense of perspective. For example, he goes on, when you sail out in a boat to the middle of an ocean where no land is in sight and view in the four directions. The ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. So the world begins to open up. The scene changes. It becomes more complex. His name is Tyson Yunka Porta, and he's an indigenous Australian academic. He has two books, one called Santalks, and the other one called Right Story, Wrong Story. And he says the mind normally focuses on points from here, point there, but it doesn't focus on in the in-between. The complexity of dependent arising, the fabric of life. And this practice invites us in to the complexity. And this openness, the practice when the self begins to thin out, we will actually experience things much more acutely. And there's a word from Donna Haraway who, in her book, Staying with the Trouble, this word bumptious. I like that word, bumptious. We will experience life, all the bumptiousness of life, much more acutely. But we'll be able to dance with it, okay? And this is, and Tahania was echoing this quote from the Buddha. He was asked once in the story goes that this ascetic came up to the Buddha, who had been practicing a long time. He hadn't practiced with the Buddha, but he wanted to know this, what it was to enlightenment, what it was to a liberation. And the Buddha was about to start his alms round, and he said, you know, not now, Bahia. He said, I got to run my alms round. Bahia asked again, Buddha said the same thing again, and then the third time, Buddha said, okay, this is how you should train, Bahia. In what is seen, let there be just the seen. In what is heard, let there be just the heard. In what is sensed, let there be just the sensed. In what is cognized, let there be just the cognized. Then, Bahia, you will not be in there, in that. When you are not in that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, then you are neither here nor there nor in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering. And the story goes that Bahia was immediately enlightened. And shortly after that, you know, he had a sense about, he said, I don't have, you know, there may not be much time, life is short. Shortly after that, he had the misfortune of stepping between a cow and its calf and was gored to death. So, you know, there's that story. Are you beginning to get the drift? I think Tahania laid it out pretty well. How simple the practice is. This is what our sitting practice cultivates, why we spend time on the cushion, to get really intimate with ourselves, to get curious, and to see all of our conditioned patterns. Okay. Now, one of the conditioned patterns in us is to push away the bad stuff. And that's conditioned. I shouldn't be that way. I should be different. This doesn't fit my story of myself, my narrative. And I'm sure we all have that conditioning, right? Because that's a selfing dynamic. It doesn't fit the narrative of me. No matter if the narrative is good or bad or whatever, it doesn't fit that narrative. Or we're not. This is not important. And so be careful in your sitting, okay? And because the mind is tricky. There's a part of the mind that's very picky about what it wants to pay attention to. It doesn't want to take in new perspective, and that's the ego part of the mind. And it doesn't want to take in that new perspective. It likes to learn new things, but new perspectives, especially new perspectives that challenges it in its authority, uh-uh. Right? So, you know, I encourage, and Tahania talked about feelings, noticing the feelings. And it's much more visceral than that. You can actually, you know, when you're sitting, just notice what the thinking feels like. Any thinking. A memory coming through, no big deal. But it all. You can feel the energy of thinking. And then you can also, you start tuning into that, then you notice there's usually some type of emotional state there, and you can feel that. And what's happened is that you've turned in under the thinking. You dropped in under to the energy pattern of it. You haven't repressed anything. You dropped into it, and now you're investigating. What does this feel like? And then you can be with the play back and forth. Oh, these sensations in my body and the thinking, the back and forth. And you can see that. Okay. Emotional states are chemical reactions in the body that last about 90 seconds or so. When they're unhindered, they'll move through the body, they'll flush through the body like that. But how often does that happen to you? And what keeps the emotions going? Huh? Yeah. Yeah. The thinking. And so when we drop down in under, we're sliding, and the space begins to open up. Sometimes it opens up immediately, and you feel that energy of the thinking falling away. That space is open. You know, it's important to notice that. And then sometimes it's more persistent. And then eventually you're riding with it, you're breathing with it, and it'll fall away eventually. And there's some stuff that it's more persistent than that, but you just stay with it. But it's important to notice when it falls away. The Buddha said in his teachings of mindfulness, notice when it's like this, and notice when it's like that difference from activation to no activation. Notice what the no activation feels like. And then this thing we call concentration, this stability begins to build in us. Because the body actually, you know, the system begins to orient towards that. It feels good. You know, you feel sort of lift in energy. And that's the degree of intimacy that can happen in your practice. And it goes on off the cushion. You start this, you go about your day, you know, you feel something, or you can just decide, I'm going to pause here, you know, and check in. You know, it doesn't have to be anything big happening, but just pause and check in. Okay? Your body actually will thank you, because now you're, you know, the constant activation, the constant stress and anxiety that we experience in our life begins to ease. Your heart will thank you. Your organs will thank you. You know, as that cortisol begins to, and the adrenaline begins to ease down, you know, we can access that much more readily. So, I think that's it. Are there any questions? Yeah.
So as I mentioned before, I've been working on my garden for the tour. And so this thing about, you know, the blossom, and then there's disappointment, and then the weeds and aversion. I think, because I've been working on this for months, and it was helpful because that article you read is very helpful, because I think I can have this, like, there's another weed, or this flower is getting overgrown by this plant and I need to cut it, and it all becomes this kind of narrow focus on achievement for a goal. And I think that article gave me the sense of, like, well, first off, and it's not that I am completely unaware of it, I'll catch myself, but it's in and of itself, it's a very interesting laboratory of, like, tensing up, making, and it's also very interesting because there is a goal. I mean, there, you know, you still want to pick the weeds, you still want to clear out and do some pruning. So it's like, it seems like it's a very, and you could do this with anything, cooking, cleaning, driving. It seems like it's.
Talking to your spouse.
Yeah. Anyway, it's very helpful, I think.
Could you say something about the chant that we chanted, the song of the Jewel Mirror Awareness? We've been chanting that all week in the session. It's sort of, it's.
I don't know if I can. Yeah, I can say a few things about it. Could you hand it to me?
Yeah, let me open it to that. Page 10. Here we go.
Go down about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the start sentences. The meaning is not in words, yet it responds to an inquiring impulse. To help with this, I'll share another translation that I carry around in my pocket. The mind, not resting in words, accommodates what arises. Okay. So that is what we're working here when we're working with our habit patterns. Our habit patterns come with habit narratives, emotional states. We're working with our fixed narratives here, our fixed ways of seeing. All of them. The Buddha said that I've taken down this house timber by timber and I'm not building it back again. He's talking about that sense of self. And so we start to see into our narratives and our conditioning, our storylines. And so we usually, when we're going about our time, we fall back on our habitual ways of seeing, perceiving, and doing things. Okay, and they're pretty deep. They precede us, actually. And so when we start to unhook from these things, we see the world differently. You know, the world becomes, in your practice, you'll notice it becomes kaleidoscopic, because things just sort of go at times. And, you know, and so not resting on our habitual ways of thinking, etc., we accommodate what arises. Now, thanks for bringing that up, giving me the opportunity to come back around to uncertainty. When you think about the dependent arising, how can there be any certainty? We do things to try to be certain, to guarantee some degree of certainty, but it's never certain, right? And then what we just talked about is how to work. You know, so Tahanya goes in, he's listening to a Dharma talk, and he's thinking it's going to be cool, and all that stuff. But then these kids start making noise. Life is like that. And so he tells us how to, it just happened. So in an easier way, he's telling us how to deal with uncertainty. When things come up, the hard things come up, how to dance with it. Okay, it's not going to be, this practice doesn't guarantee an easy life. What it begins to reshape is our relationship to it, what's coming up. When the Buddha talked about suffering, he says there is suffering, and there is suffering because of craving and selfing. Well, but there's that, so it is, there's suffering, there's old age, sickness, and death and stuff like that, the uncertainty of life, which we can't avoid, but the response to it we can work with. He talked about the two darts or the two arrows. The first arrow is the existential stuff, the second arrow is what we add to it. And he said that's often much more painful. We can work with that. And then I'll touch on, when communing with the source, when traveling the pathways, that's our practice, that's life, that's the road. Embrace the territory and treasure the road. Embrace it. Treasure it. Notice what it begins to do for you as a human being. Okay? I think it really helps us flourish as human beings. Life becomes richer. We feel stuff much more acutely, but life does become richer.
So you talk about thinking it is what keeps the emotion flowing away. But you also mentioned we should ask smart questions, drop and invest it.
Could you say these last parts again, please? I'm sorry.
So you also mentioned we should invest, investing the thought. We should ask questions about it. Does it mean we are just trying to reshape the thought, not just avoiding the thinking?
No, not necessarily. It's looking into the causes and conditions. Okay, you see that, you know, you're being alive, what's happening? Why is this happening? You know, and that's what Tahani was saying, you know, why is this? How did this start? The mind was really peaceful. How did it get to be angry? And it, so then it drops into investigating, you know, we got these guide points now, okay? Craving and aversion. So we can very simply locate that in the body. We drop into the craving and aversion, into that dynamic in the body, and we're just with it. That's what he did. And it went back and forth. Went back from craving to aversion, back and forth. And then pretty soon it just settled out. That's the type of investigation. Okay. If you notice, you know, what can happen is you can start off on a whole other trajectory of narratives and stuff. Then you just come back. Okay? So you're always looking in at what's underneath this. Craving, aversion. Go back to this, to working with uncertainty. You know, when I heard that question, how can I work with uncertainty in life? Then, you know, I go, oh, well, what's behind that question? And I heard fear, right? And so then we turn into the fear. So it's that movement, okay, that we investigate. We begin to know this is the way the organism functions. Anger is always a secondary emotion, okay? So then we can pause, you know, when in anger we can pause and we can say, oh, what's here? What's behind this? And it's often fear, frustration, shame, guilt, embarrassment, things like that. It becomes anger, and then a lot of it gets, that anger gets projected out onto somebody else. But it's that kind of investigation. We don't have to get too analytical about it. Yeah.
I just had a question come up. Now, is this form, I mean, you say we try to trace it back and investigate into what's beneath things, and is this not some form of clinging? This needing to get to the bottom of something, and it's helpful to understand why and where things come from, but there's a part of me that feels like it might be some sort of like clinging to, like, I need to know why it happens or where it comes from. And even though we're telling ourselves, oh, we're not going to be attached to it, the act of actually going after it and chasing it deeper and finding the root cause of where it comes from, maybe could it be some form of attachment?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hazard. That's a possibility. I'm not saying going back to your childhood and, you know, that stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Although that can, you know, this, you know, when we get to, when we're noticing our emotional states and what they feel like, right? It may well take us back to that, to a root. It'll happen very quickly. It'll go like that. Okay, so because that it's an old feeling in there, and then a connection is made. Now, if you're going, what you're describing is what I call going down a rabbit hole. Okay, and like there are three dynamics of the mind. There's a spin cycle, and then there's the going down the rabbit hole, and then there's the monkey mind. What you're describing is when you get pulled into a rabbit hole. And so it's, you know, you and there'll be a narrative. There'll be a, you can feel it. You can feel the selfing energy. It feels different than just saying, you know, connecting, just remembering and connecting. You know, the first move, all it has to be, is there attachment? Is there craving, aversion right now? That's all you have to do. All right.
It seems like you're presupposing something's underneath all of this, like say, Buddha nature. I mean, can you speak on? I mean, because it seems like in all of this, there's some essence that we're trusting in, or something. Or,
that's an interesting word. I wouldn't say essence, because that's just, you know, no, I wouldn't say that word. And I think that's, when we're talking about Buddha nature, we have to be very careful with that. Because then we're making something of that's not there. Okay. However, I'll ask this simple question. What kind of decisions do you make when you're activated, when you're ticked off? What kind of decisions do you make? Good ones? How clearly do you see things when there's that kind of activation? Okay. And then when the activation falls away, what's happening? Do you see more clearly? Do you make better decisions? That's what I'll say to that question. So how are we doing, you know?
We have time for one more question.
Okay.
I have questions.
Okay.
So, teacher, what is your opinion on technologies on our thinking? For example, in the future, we have a computer to brain interface, and we can program what our perspectives are. Will that help human beings to achieve enlightenment easily?
I don't think so. But that's a bias. That's a bias I have.
Bias, okay.
Yeah. That may be a lot of bias speaking.
Mm-hmm.
But the process that we're talking about is just you with you.
Okay.
You with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. I really don't think we need computers for that.
Okay.
You know, I'm sort of, you know, I may irritate some folks here, but
mm-hmm.
I'm really skeptical. I get the use of AI and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that, but I'm skeptical of it. But, you know, learn to trust you. Learn to just be with you and trust you. Okay? I do have, you know, all the rest of it, you know, social media and all that stuff, you know, think
mm-hmm.
about all the selfing and all that stuff that's going
mm-hmm.
on there. Okay, thank you.
Page 2 again.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.